Back in 1981, I began having some stomach problems. I'd come in from a meeting, and Kay and I had gone out that night, and about 7 o'clock I started feeling very, very sick, very nauseated, and I thought it was just something that I had eaten, and that eventually, you know, it would take care of itself. Well, about midnight, the pain had become so unbearable that Kay took me to the emergency room at the hospital, and they put me in the hospital and kept me there for 3 days, made a bunch of tests, and couldn't find anything wrong with me and let me go. I didn't think much about it. I said, well, how about that? That happened. And but about 6 months later, I was finished a meeting in Covington, Kentucky on Friday night, and about midnight Friday night, that same pain hit again. And I thought, well, I'll tough it out and get on the plane in the morning and see my doctor when I get back. But about 7 o'clock that morning, I had been up all night, and that pain had just increased to such an intensity, I finally called the pastor and said, I need to go to the hospital. So they put me in the hospital and kept me there again for about 3 days and ran all kinds of tests. And again, they couldn't find anything wrong, and they released me. Well, that began to happen, not once every 6 months, but about once every 3 months, and then it became more frequent. It got to a place where it was nearly once a month that I would have that kind of an attack. And it got so bad that when I would go to a town to begin a meeting, as soon as I'd located my motel, I would locate the nearest hospital. Because, and first thing I'd ask the pastor when I got there, I said, do you have a doctor in your church? And I always felt more secure if I was in a church that had a doctor, because the good chance before the week was out, I was going to need him. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, that went on for several years. I lost about 30 pounds and looked terrible and felt just as bad as I looked. So much so that one night while I was sitting on the platform and Kay was out in the congregation watching me, she became so fearful for my well-being, she said afterwards, she said, I'm canceling your schedule and you're not going to travel anymore until we find out what's wrong. Well, anyway, finally, the doctor, a digestive disease specialist, and I met in an unusual way, and he began to talk to me and look at me and make tests, and he came to the conclusion that actually what my problem was, I didn't have an ulcer, it wasn't cancer or anything else like that, but he announced that I had a very, what I consider to be an unspiritual affliction. He said, your problem is stress and pressure and tension. These years of traveling, overbooked schedules and running after airplanes and all of that sort of stuff that goes with it, actually, life in the fast food lane had caught up with me. And he said, your stomach has more sense than your brain has, and it's trying to tell you to slow down. And all of this is just the stress and the pressure and the tension that's going on in your life, and that's what's making you sick. Well, they began to treat me accordingly, and I was in the doctor's office one day, and he said, now, preacher, if we're going to get you back on the road to normalcy, I said, that'll be a new road, actually. And he said, well, if we're going to get you back on the road to normalcy, there are some things you must start doing right away. And he picked up a piece of paper and pencil and began to write. First of all, he said, I want you to walk 3 miles a day, every day, at least 4 days a week. 3 miles a day, every day, 4 days a week. He said, and do it in under 45 minutes. We don't want any lollygagging out there. Number two, he said, I want you to see to it that you eat 2 well-balanced, nutritious meals every day. 2 of them, at least, well-balanced, nutritious meals every day. Number three, I want you to plan on getting 7 to 8 hours of sleep every night. 7 to 8 hours of sleep every night. Remember, the hours before midnight are best. And that's when I said, doctor, can't you just give me a pill? He looked at me and smiled. He thought I was joking and went back and began writing some more. What he didn't know is I'd never been more serious in my life. I wanted a pill. I mean, I didn't want to do all this stuff he was talking about. That's discipline. And I'll tell you something, folks, discipline is very inconvenient. And just walking 3 miles a day, every day, 4 days a week. Well, traveling like I do, you're in motels and such as that. It's not always easy to find a place to walk. And in doing it in under 45 minutes, boy, that's picking them up and putting them down. I that's really putting it out there. And two square meals a day, two well-balanced meals a day. You've got to be joking. I mean, to me, a well-balanced meal was a ding-dong in one hand, a Coke in the other. I mean, that's about as well-balanced as they got. 7 to 8 hours of sleep every night? You've got to be joking. And before midnight, my soul, I do my work at night. And when the meeting is over, and if you go out and get a bite to eat, it's 10:30, 11 o'clock before you get back to your room. And by the time you cool down, you know, and you're keyed up so much, I never got to sleep before 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. It's impossible to get 7 to 8 hours of sleep, and no hours before midnight unless you started in the afternoon. And so what I needed really was a pill. That's what I needed. I wanted some pill that I could take that would, make me well, and I wouldn't have to do all this other stuff, see. What I was looking for was a pill that would allow me to continue to live as I wanted to live without suffering the consequences of it. I wanted a quick fix. I wanted a shortcut. I've talked to a lot of doctors since then, and the majority of them have agreed that the patients that come to them do not come wanting to change their lifestyle. They come seeking some magic pill that they can take that will allow them to live as they want, but without suffering the consequences. And I think most of us are that way. In this day of advancing medical technology, we wonder, why isn't there a pill? Why do I have to do these things? And I believe we're much the same way in the spiritual realm. I think we're always looking for a quick fix, a shortcut, some pill, some experience, some new truth that will usher into spiritual maturity overnight, just like that. When I first entered the ministry, and I was just a teenager, and I was in a great church where they would have the greatest preachers in the country, as far as I knew, in the world, come in and preach, and I was exposed to all of the great preachers past and present, and I would hear about D.L. Moody and Spurgeon, and I'd read all these biographies, and it became clear to me that in the Christian life, there was an experience that you had to have that kind of sort of finished off salvation, you know, or put the cap on it, or put the icing on the cake. I mean, right now, as a Christian, you're struggling with the world, the flesh, and the devil, and you have maybe not a besetting sin, but you have a besetting temptation. But not to worry, because one of these days, you're going to discover this truth, or one of these days you're going to have this cataclysmic experience that all these other great Christians have had, and immediately in the twinkling of an eye, all your problems are going to be solved and your troubles done with, and you're going to emerge from that experience a spiritual giant. And I knew it had to happen. I was about 15 or 16 at the time, and I would look at the old people in our church, those who were 20 and 25, and I would say to myself, well, I'm struggling with these things now, but I know that when I get to be their age, I will by then have conquered this. And when I got to be 20 or 25, I looked at the real old people, those that were 30 and 35, and for heaven's sake, they had children. And I said, I know this much, boy, when I get old enough to be married and have kids, I know by that time I will have solved the problem. I would have discovered the truth. I will have had the experience. I said that when I was 30. I said that when I was 40. I stopped saying it when I was 50, because by then I'd come to the conclusion there is no such thing. There is no such once-for-all experience that you can have that will settle all the problems of life in a single moment and usher you, full-grown, fully mature, into a revved-up version of the Christian life. And overnight make you a D.L. Moody or a Charles Spurgeon or somebody like that. As a matter of fact, I was surprised at the way God worked in my life. And it has been that way continually. I confess to you that God has not worked in my life anywhere near the way I expected Him to work. I came into this ministry and into what I call the seriousness of the Christian life. I was saved when I was 9, but I never got really serious about serving the Lord until I was a teenager. And at that point, I came into that, you see, thinking that I knew exactly how God was going to work in my life. But I confess to you that all this time, God has kept me off balance and continually catches me off guard and has not worked in the way that I anticipated. And so several years ago, I became very concerned about this. And I decided that I wanted to find out, how does God work in a person's life? And I tried to empty my mind of all preconceived ideas and went back to the Bible, and especially the characters in the Bible, to see how God worked in their lives. And that's why you'll have noticed this week that I do quite a bit of biographical preaching. Abraham and Job. Because all of this grew out of my seeking to understand, how does God really work in a person's life to make them what He wants them to be? And I have been surprised. There's one story in the Bible that helped me, I believe, above all others, and I want to share that with you tonight. Genesis chapter 32, if you'll open your Bibles to that passage of Scripture. Genesis chapter 32. And I want to read verses 24 through 32. Now we're going to read that familiar and strange story of Jacob wrestling with the angel. Now, you know who Jacob was, of course. He and his twin brother Esau. They were the children of Rebekah. And Rebekah had previously been barren, unable to bear children. And so she had prayed that God would bless her and give her a child. And so He did. But as she was carrying this child, I mean, it was like a war going on inside her womb. And she went to God one day and she said, "Lord, I thought this was supposed to be a blessing." Not the last mother that said that, I'm sure. But she said, "Lord, I thought this was supposed to be a blessing, and yet it's like a war going on." And God said, "Well, that's it. There is a war going on. You're carrying twins. You're carrying two nations in your womb. And they're going to fight all the days of their life. And they just got a head start on it. They're fighting right now in the womb." Well, when they were born, Esau was born first. He came out of the womb covered with red hair, and so they named him Esau, which is red hairy one. Jacob was born second. He came out of the womb gripping the heel of Esau, his elder brother, and so they named him Jacob, which means he who catches by the heel. And Jacob lived up to his name. If you want to know the kind of person Jacob was, you just need to know what that name means. He who catches by the heel. The picture is of some sneaky guy. He comes up behind you, and while you're walking, you see, and you lift your foot, well, that's when you are most vulnerable, and he grabs your heel, and then he trips you up. It means someone who is a deceiver, a cheat, a falsifier, a supplanter. For instance, in Jeremiah 17:9, it says, "The heart is deceitful above all things. The word is Jacob. The heart is a Jacob above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it?" And so Jacob was that kind of fellow. He lived by his wits. He was a con man. You remember he conned Esau out of his birthright. And then when Isaac, their father, was dying and was going to give the blessing to Esau, which was the elder brother, Jacob disguised himself as Esau. And since Isaac was blind, he couldn't really see the difference. And so he not only conned his brother out of the birthright, now he conned him out of his blessing. Now when Esau heard that, he said, "I'm going to kill him." And that's when his mother suggested it might be a good time to take a trip to visit Uncle Laban. And so for about 20 years. And so Jacob took off in fear of his life and went to Uncle Laban. And he's been there 20 years. He's married to two daughters, Leah and Rachel. Now he's a wealthy man and he's coming back home. This is 20 years later. He's coming back home. But Esau has vowed to kill him. And so Jacob is scared. And he's been praying all along, "God, somehow work it out that I can see Esau and live." And that's what he's been praying. Well, I know he's nervous because today they've just received word that Esau is headed their way and he has 400 men with him. So they come to this little river, Jabbok, And Jacob says, now I'm going to stay over on this side by myself tonight. I think he was thinking, I've got some praying to do. And I want everybody else to go ahead and cross the river, and I'll come over in the morning. So he takes his wives, his families, his 11 children, all of his companies, all of his servants, and he sends them across. And he stays by himself on this side of that little river. And that's where we read, beginning with verse 24. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh, or hip it is, so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, let me go, for it is daybreak. But Jacob replied, I will not let you go unless you bless me. The man asked him, what is your name? Jacob, he answered. Then the man said, your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome. Jacob said, please tell me your name. But he replied, why do you ask my name? Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, it is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared. The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the tendon attached to the socket of the hip, because the socket of Jacob's hip was touched near the tendon. Now, this story of Jacob's encounter with this man, Hosea 12 tells us it was an angel. This story has a special significance beyond itself. And there are a couple of things in this story that let you know that it's recorded not just to record a historical incident in the life of a man, but that it has a special spiritual significance to it. One thing that lets you know that is that last verse that talks about that cultic ban on eating a certain portion of the meat. In other words, the Jews of that day considered this event to be of such spiritual significance that there was a ritualistic ban on eating certain of that meat out of recognition of what God had done in the life of Jacob. But there's another thing that makes me know this has great spiritual significance. This is where Jacob receives the name Israel for the first time. Now the name Israel is given, which means a prince of God. So actually, what you have here is a picture of how God takes a Jacob, a con man, a cheat, a fraud, a deceiver, and turns him into a prince or princess of God. This is a picture of how God takes us where we are in all of our phoniness and makes us into what He wants us to be. This story is a pattern, a picture of how God does that. And do you know what it is? Do you know what the Christian life is? It is a struggle till the breaking of day. They wrestled until the breaking of day. Now, this was a surprising thing for Jacob, because Jacob had been praying that God would deliver him from the hand of Esau. Well, God answered his prayer, but not in the way that Jacob expected. I'd like to share with you tonight some of the surprises that Jacob encountered in his dealing with God. They have been surprises that I myself have experienced, and I think maybe you'll find that you identify with them too. Number one, in my Christian life, as I have struggled to know God and to be what God wants me to be, I've been surprised to discover that my toughest battles have been with God rather than the devil. My toughest fights have been with God rather than the devil. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that we don't wrestle the devil or wrestle spiritual powers. I do believe the Bible teaches a spiritual warfare. I'm not saying that doesn't exist. All I'm saying is that I've discovered that my toughest battles, my most fierce battles, have not been with the devil, but they've been with God. My toughest adversary has not been the devil. It's been the Lord. Now, what I'm saying to you is this. I have found it easier to say no to the devil than I have to say yes to God. Now, Jacob didn't know who he was wrestling with at first. But as they wrestled, somehow, by some means, a revelation came to Jacob, and he realized that who he was wrestling with was not an enemy, but it was the Lord. Because suddenly he says, I will not let you go till you bless me. Suddenly that which Jacob had been trying to get rid of, now he clings to for dear life and says, I will not let you go until you bless me. And whatever you want to say, like I said, Hosea tells us it was an angel. Some say it was a pre-incarnate appearing of the Lord Jesus. Whatever that was, whatever that man was, we know this much, it was the Lord. Jacob was wrestling with God. Now let me ask you a question. Who do you suppose Jacob thought that was? At first. I mean, here is Jacob sitting in the dark. He's all alone. You know the boy's got to be nervous and uptight. And all of a sudden, without any warning, this man out of the darkness leaps on him and throws him to the ground. Now, what do you suppose was Jacob's first thought? Who do you think he thought that was? Hey, I imagine he thought it was Esau. That would have been my first thought. Oh, my goodness, Esau. He's taken a page out of my own book and he's got the drop on me. I'm done for. And there he is wrestling to the ground. Or maybe he thought it's one of Esau's henchmen, you know, maybe one of Esau's men that has sneaked up in the dark and jumped on him. Maybe he thought it was some thug passing by and seized the opportunity to mug a tourist. Maybe that was what he thought. In the Talmud, the old rabbis had a very interesting theory. Some of the old rabbis believed that this was Jacob's guardian angel. I want you to think about that for a moment. Here is Jacob, such an obnoxious character, that the very angel God has given him to guard him can't stand him, and so he jumps and beats up on him himself, you know. Well, the truth of the matter is, we don't know what Jacob thought. We don't know who Jacob thought that was. But I believe I know this much. I believe that when that man jumped on him and threw him to the ground, Jacob's first thought was not, oh joy, somebody's come to bless me. No, no sir, this is an enemy. Nobody but an enemy would do this. This is the work of an aggressor. This is the work of somebody who's out to do me in. This is somebody who is against me. This is somebody who's trying to kill me. And so he wrestled and wrestled and wrestled. And then suddenly he discovered it was God he was wrestling with. Of course, this wasn't the first encounter Jacob had with God, you remember. 20 years earlier, he had had an encounter with God. That night when he left home for the first time, running away from Esau, he spent the night at Bethel. And you remember that wonderful vision he had at Bethel? He had a dream and he saw heaven open and he saw a ladder reaching from earth to heaven and there were angels going up and down that ladder. Boy, what a vision. Man, talk about a magnificent experience. That must have... I'll tell you how great it was right then and there. Jacob signed a pledge card and started to tithe. It takes a pretty great experience for a man to do that right on the spot. He saw this great experience, had this great experience. And, oh, I wish I could have an experience like that. Dear God, what I need to do is see an angel or two. I tell you, I struggle and I get down in the dumps. And boy, I'm telling you, my Christian life is sagging in the middle and everything. And Lord, I believe if you could just show me heaven, if I could just see heaven open up, if I could just see angels going up and down on a stair, if I could just feel chill bumps playing leapfrog up and down my spine. God, if I could just see some great vision, I believe, Lord, that'd solve all my problems. Well, Jacob had that kind of an experience. And here he is 20 years later, same old Jacob. You know, folks, it scares me to realize how many great experiences we can have with God and not be changed. Now, I want you to notice that first experience we had with God 20 years earlier when he was a young man was a very pleasant and happy experience. But it didn't change him. Now, this second experience is mighty painful. Well, it is painful. And it's the one that changes him. You know, you get to thinking about this. I always assumed that the older I got, the easier my battles would be. But I'm telling you tonight, the older I get, the tougher my battles are. I told Kay the other night, I wish the only thing I was worrying about today was what I was worrying about when I was 18. Boy, I had a lot of nice, pleasant experience with God back then. Of course, back then he was just after pimples. Now he's after tumors, and that's another matter altogether. He wrestled with God. Now, I think it is significant that it's a wrestling match. You see, if you come up to me after the service and punch me in the face and say, you want to fight? You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to run out that door. I don't want to fight. But if you come up from behind and throw your arms around me and wrestle me to the ground, I have no choice but to fight. There is a certain inevitability about it. And I believe there is significance in that this is a wrestling match. In other words, here is Jacob, who in effect has been slipping out of God's hands for 20 years. And now God gets him alone. Nobody can rescue him. In the dark. He can't really tell what's going on. And he throws a hammerlock on him. And I think in effect God is saying, Jacob, you and I have sparred around long enough. We're going to have it out once and for all. You will not escape. And may I say to you tonight that I do not believe the life-changing experiences come to us at a 30-second experience at an altar, although I don't decry those. But I have found and I believe that the great life-changing experiences come to us over a period of time when we're alone and in the dark and wrestling with mystery. And God puts his hold on Jacob and says, son, we're going to have it out. And the angel, as he's wrestling, says to Jacob, what is your name? Now, that's always seemed a little fishy to me. Do you mean to tell me that angel didn't know who he was wrestling with? You suppose that angel just happened by nonchalantly and saw Jacob over there and said, I don't know that boy, but I think I'll jump on him. Do you reckon God sent that angel from heaven with an arrest warrant made out to whom it may concern? No, I believe the angel knew who he was wrestling with, don't you? I believe he knew who he's wrestling with. Well, then why in the world did he ask his name? Well, he really wasn't asking his name. In Hebrew, if you want to know somebody's name, you say, who are you? And if all the angel had been wanting was identification, he would have said, who are you? He didn't say that. He said, what is your name? Now, we must remember that for the Hebrews, the name was equal to the character. Know the name, you know the person. You know what he was asking? He wasn't saying, what name are you called by? He said, what are you? Who are you really? What are you really like? And when Jacob said, my name is Jacob, he wasn't identifying himself. He was confessing himself. You see, the angel wasn't after information. He was after confession. And when Jacob said, my name is Jacob, what he was saying is, my name is trickster, fraud, cheat, deceiver. And it is at this point that I understand why my toughest battles are with God. Because, you see, the devil, all he wants me to do is commit sin, which I kind of want to do anyway. But what God is after is to go down into the guts of our soul and rip the Jacob out of us. He's out to change us, see, from inside out. He's out to change us. And we don't really want to be changed, actually. Oh, we don't mind some surface changes. All of us have had cosmetic surgery done on us by the Lord in meeting after meeting, and makes us feel good for a few weeks, and we're content. You know, we know there's things we're not supposed to be do, and we're not everything we ought to be, and so we'll let God do a little, you know, superficial cutting on us and touch us, you know, at a certain level. But for most of us, we have never allowed God to get down in to the basement of our being, where what we are is really what we are, and we've never come clean and said, yes, this is what I am. I've been a phony all my life. My name is Jacob. My name is phony. My name is a liar. My name is adulterer. My name is whatever you are on the inside. That's what I'm saying, you see. And that's why the battle is so tough. Is because, you see, we don't really want to be exposed, even to ourselves. We hide from ourselves. Why? Of course, you know this is true. Because in meetings and worship services and other places, when God begins to get a little too close for comfort, you back off. We'll let God just in so far. And let Him deal with us just to a certain extent. But for the most part, when God begins to go down the steps into the cellar of our being, and He's saying, no, I'm after what's down there at the core. I want to get to the core. And I want to rip the Jacob out of you and change you, totally change you inside and out. That's when we back off and we resist. Because we're afraid to change. Most of all, we're afraid to face ourselves. I was reading yesterday over there in the Genesis when it says that God made Adam and Eve and they were naked and they were not ashamed. That's interesting. I think their nakedness represents, well, the fact they had nothing to hide. They were their true selves. This is what we are, and we're not ashamed of it. But when they sinned against God, they ran and hid. Why? They said, for we are naked, and we were ashamed. And so they covered themselves. And so began human history, covering ourselves, covering ourselves, covering ourselves. Layer after layer, layer after layer. Why? Because we're ashamed of what we really are. And we don't want to face it. And that's why I say our toughest battles are with God rather than the devil. And some of us have been running from Him for a long time. And we've never yet let Him capture us. But I want to tell you something. If you're saved, if you are saved, it is inevitable. One of these days, God is going to put a hammerlock on you and say, we're going to have it out. Enough of this running around. Enough of this cosmetic surgery. Enough of this feel-good religion stuff. We're going to have it out. I'm out to change you. So that's the first surprise. But there was a second surprise, and it's this. I've been surprised, as was Jacob, to discover that many times I've often tried to throw off, get rid of, my greatest blessings. Well, what a change of events here. One minute, Jacob is trying to get loose from this guy. And then seconds later, he's clinging to him. And the angel says, let me go. Jacob says, I will not let you go till you bless me. Now, wait just a minute, Jacob. Make up your mind. It wasn't just a few minutes ago until you were trying to get loose from this guy. Well, yeah, I was. That was my first... Well, what's happened? Well, I don't know really what's happened, but I don't know. Somehow I've come to realize that there's a blessing wrapped up in this guy somewhere, and I'm not letting him go until I get it. When Kay and I travel together, sometimes we'll go, we have some time off, we'll go shopping, you know. We like to drive the back roads and find these little shops and things, and Kay likes to go into antique shops. She likes to go into antique shops. I don't care for them myself. Antique shops always depress me. You know why they depress me? Because I've thrown away better stuff than that. Matter of fact, I think I threw that exact piece there away. And now you're asking $600 for it. Isn't that something? I mean, haven't you done that? Sure you have. I've been looking for my baseball cards now for years. I started saving baseball cards when I was, in 1948. I saved them from 1948 until 1952 or 3, along there. And I had some great ones. I had a Hank Greenberg, a Bob Feller, Bob Lemon, a young Mickey Mantle. My goodness, you know how much those things would be worth today? But I don't know where they are because my mom had died before I realized how valuable they were. And so I couldn't ask her what she did with them when I went off to college. And I asked my dad. He didn't even know I had any baseball cards. But I would go, every time we'd go visit Dad, I'd go through the house, I'd go through the barn, I'd open every box, every closet, every drawer. I put them in my Cub Scout scrapbook, I remember that. But I can't find those baseball cards. Of course, and I know what Mom did with them. I know what Mom did with them. I know what she did. When I went off to college, she said to herself, when I was a child, I acted like a child, but now I've gone to college. I put away childish things. And she chucked them. I know she threw them in the trash. I can't believe I sold my 65 Mustang for $400. But how was I to know that one of these days that thing going to be worth 10 times that much? You know what I'm telling my kids? Save everything. Don't throw anything away. I mean, save it all, boy. I mean, save it all. I mean, you may have to Bill Barnes to store it in, but listen, it'll support you in your old age. I mean, boy, I save all manner of stuff now. When the Gulf War was going on, I bought all this stuff about the Gulf War. I've got it packed away somewhere. Someday it's going to be valuable, you know. Save it all. I mean, save everything, folks. Save it all. You see, you know what my problem is? My problem is I can't tell treasure from trash. What I consider junk today will more than likely turn out to be an antique tomorrow. But you see, the problem with us is we have this fatal belief that we can accurately interpret everything that comes into our lives. See? Listen, folks, I know a blessing when I see one. You're trying to tell me this is a blessing? No way. That is a curse. I'm getting rid of it as soon as I can. But listen, sometimes blessings come dressed in the rags of a curse. Sometimes kings dress like paupers. And sometimes we entertain angels unaware. Now, you know, I'm going to have to say to you, as I look back on my Christian life, and as I look at my Christian life right now, that the greatest works that God has done in my life have been against my pleasure and against my will. And most of the things that God has sent my way to bless me and to change me, I've tried to get rid of. And would have if I could have. You know, when you've got a theory or a philosophy about something like the Christian life, as you go along, you may come upon something that presents an obstacle to that philosophy, to that belief, because it contradicts your philosophy of Christian living. It's an obstacle. It's a contradiction. And so you struggle to get rid of that obstacle because it contradicts your basic philosophy of the Christian life. But if you're not careful, that which at first was an obstacle to your philosophy can become the very centerpiece of it and the very foundation of it. Now, originally, see, I felt that a lot of these things, these angels that the Lord had sent my way, were obstacles to my philosophy of Christian living. This idea of struggling, this idea of wrestling. But I've come to where it is no longer a contradiction to that. It has become almost the centerpiece of that. Because as I study the Bible and I study the people of the Bible, I see that God dealt with them pretty much in the same way. Somewhere along the way, they wrestled with an angel. And he said, I will not let you go until you bless me. Now, one of the interesting things to me is as they wrestle, the angel says, let me go, the sun is about to break. Now, that's another fishy thing about this story. Do you believe that angel was stronger than Jacob? Do you think that angel couldn't get away from Jacob if he wanted to? Do you believe that Jacob was strong enough to hold that angel from getting away? I don't believe that. No. See, I believe that fight was fixed. See, I think that angel was saying, let me go, let me go, let me go. But I think under his breath he was saying, but I hope you don't, for if you hang on a little bit longer, you'll get the blessing. And so Jacob said, I will not let you go until you bless me. Now, for a long time, I believed that faith was the power to change things the way you wanted them to be. To me, that was faith. That power to just change circumstances the way you wanted them to be. Now, let me just insert real quickly. I'm not preaching a passive Christianity. I'm not saying just fold your arms and don't do anything. Listen, I believe if there's something adverse in your life and you can get rid of it, get rid of it. If I have a headache, I'm going to take an aspirin. But you see, those things I can change, they're not my problems. They're inconvenient, but they're not my problems. My problems are those things I would change if I could, but I can't. Now, I believe that I stand before this barrier, this obstacle that I'm trying to change because I can't make any progress, of course, as long as this obstacle is there. I was doing good until I came to this barrier. And now I'm stuck. And I've got to get rid of that barrier because I can't go on until I get rid of that barrier. Okay? But I can't get rid of that barrier. I can't pray it away. I can't praise it away. I can't plead the blood over it. I've done everything. I'd wear garlic around my neck if I thought I could get rid of that thing. But I can't get rid of it. And I believe sooner or later it ought to dawn on me, hey, there's a blessing in that somewhere. And I'm not going to let you go until you bless me. I don't believe that faith is necessarily the power to change things the way you want them to be. I believe that faith is often the courage to accept things as they are. To embrace those things and draw them to yourself and allow God to use them as fuel for the journey and construction material to build into you the kind of life He wants you to be. You know, it occurs to me that the very thing that you may be wrestling against tonight, the very thing that you're trying to get loose from, may be the very thing that God has allowed to come into your life, maybe the very thing that changes you, maybe the very thing that sets you free and makes you confront yourself and vomit up the Jacob and become what God wants you to be. It's a big surprise that sometimes the very things that I've been wrestling against have been the very things that God has been using to make me what He wants me to be. Well, there's a third surprise. I've been surprised to discover that good and bad run on parallel tracks and they usually arrive about the same time. Good and bad run on parallel tracks and they usually arrive about the same time. He said, preacher, what are you talking about? I don't see that in the Bible anywhere.
Well, it's not there in so many words, I must confess. But good and bad, running on parallel tracks and arriving about the same time. Now, you see, my view of life for most of my life was this. You see, I know right now I've got problems. Right now there are troubles. But I know this is not the way life's supposed to be. And I know one of these days when I get it all together and have learned all the stuff I'm supposed to learn, then there'll be nothing but just good stuff coming to me. See, that's the way God really wants your life. That's the way your life's supposed to be. Right now there's some good stuff coming down the pike, but there's some bad stuff too. So I know that this isn't really the way God wants it to be. I know that one of these days, you know, when I finish school or when the kids get grown or when all of this happens, well, then my life will really start. Right now, this isn't really life, you see. I mean, I'm just sort of rehearsing, you know, for the real thing. And I know that eventually when I am everything God wants me to be and God has total control of my life, then there'll be nothing but just good stuff coming down. There's some good stuff now, but there's a lot of bad stuff too. So what I'm going to do is pull over here in this rest area, put my life on hold, just sort of wait it out, you know, because I know this isn't the way life's supposed to be. So I'm just going to kind of wait until all that bad stuff exhausts itself and gets past. Then I'll get back on the road. Now don't tell me you've never tried to put your life on hold. Somebody said to me not long ago, life is what happens while you're waiting for life to start. I woke up one day and realized that I'd been living my life all along. My wife said not long ago, the thing about life is it's so daily. It was a surprise to me that I'd been living my life. I thought I had it on hold. That none of this counted. This was just, well, this was the pre-game show. The real game hadn't started yet. The real game will start when all the bad is gone, nothing but good coming down. I woke up at 50 and discovered I'd been living all along. Didn't know it. But that's the way we are, aren't we? Don't we? I mean, we believe that ideally, what God really wants and what's going to happen one of these days when you and I get it all together, going to be nothing but just good stuff coming. But folks, that's not the way life is. Good and bad run on parallel tracks and they usually arrive about the same time. Now, Jacob got what he wanted, didn't he? I mean, he prayed and asked God to deliver him from Esau so he could face Esau and not die. Well, he got what he wanted. But he also got something he didn't want. He got a limp. Now, I wasn't counting on this, Lord. I don't remember asking for a limp anywhere in any of my prayers. The Bible says, and there he blessed him. By the way, this is the only place in the Bible where a blessing is obtained by struggle. Blessings are always conferred. But this one was obtained by struggle. Why? Because Jacob had never had to struggle for anything in his life. He lived by his wits. He's a con man. But this one he had to struggle for. And the word blessed means a transfer of power. You know what happened? When that angel blessed him, that angel transferred his power to Jacob. And then gave him a limp so it wouldn't show. The power, I mean. Well, he got what he wanted. But he got something he didn't want. He got that limp. God blessed him. God answered his prayer. And so when he got two things there. He got two things there. He got the blessing and he got the limp. He saw God face to face and he got popped in the hip. Now let's watch him. Jacob, what are you going to name this place? You got a choice. You can name it the place where I saw God, or you can name it the place where I got the limp. What are you going to name it? What are you naming your place? You see, you can tell a lot about a person by what they name those places. See, there was good and bad, but Jacob named it the place of the good. Most of us name it the place of the bad. All we can think about is, boy, that's where I got my limp. That's where God hurt me. That's where I got cheated out of my job. That's where I went bankrupt. That's where my child got sick and died. That's where my wife left me. You see, the names we give to places. Place of pain. Place of torment. Place of affliction. Well, you name it that, and that's all you're going to get out of it. You'll limp, but you'll not limp with power. But Jacob said, he named the place Peniel, for I've seen God face to face. Well, what about that limp? Yeah, well, that's beside the point. What really happened is, I saw God face to face. Good and bad run on parallel tracks and usually arrive about the same time. Jesus had something to say about this in Matthew chapter 13. He gave a parable of the wheat and the tares. Now, preachers have preached on that for years, and a lot of times, unfortunately, a lot of we preachers have preached that the tares were unsaved church members. But that's not so. If the tares are unsaved church members, then Jesus says, let them go to hell. Because he says, don't do anything about the tares, just leave them there and we'll pull them up at the end and throw them in the fire. He's not talking about unsaved church members. No, he's talking about something else. Well, this man had a wheat field. And one night, an enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat. And when they sprung up, the servants came and said, Master, we sowed good seed. We sowed wheat. Whence came these tares? Where did these tares come from? Now, a lot of us have asked that same question in not the same words. I mean, I've sowed nothing but good seed in my life. I've sowed nothing but good seed in rearing my children. I've sown nothing but good seed. I want to know where these tares came from. Well, an enemy has done this, and you can well assure yourself that every time you're going to be sowing some good seed for God, the devil's going to be following up sowing some bad seed. Well, the servant, and Jesus said, well, an enemy has done this. Well, the servants then made a suggestion that is the most logical thing you'll want to do. I mean, this is the right thing to do. This is the natural thing to do. They said, you want us to go up and tear out the tares? Well, of course. I mean, the tares don't belong there. And naturally, you want to get rid of the tares. But Jesus said, no, don't do that. For in pulling up the tares, you'll pull up the wheat. And it's too early to pull up the wheat. It's not ready for harvest yet. He says, let them grow together. And the Greek has the idea of letting them grow in between, among, on top of. In other words, intertwined. They are so intertwined, Jesus says. They are so intertwined. I'm going to make up a word. Unravelable. You can't unravel them. Can I make up a word? I mean, Webster made up words. I can make up a word. They are so unravelable that if you try to pull up the tares, you're going to pull up the wheat too. No, let them grow together until the time of harvest, and then we'll rip it all up, and the wheat will be ready for harvest, and then the tares we can throw in the fire. What's Jesus talking about? Well, he's talking about the world is the field, and he's talking about the sons of God and the sons of this world. He's talking about the mixture of good and evil, the mystery of good and evil in this world. The fact that good and evil grow together. Now, the mystery of good and evil is the mixture of good and evil, that they are mixed. And that you say, well, I'm going to get rid of all the evil. Well, sometimes you can't tell one from the other, and they grow together so much that best just let it alone and let God do the separating. Good and evil growing together. Now let me ask you to do something for me. I want everybody right now at this moment to think of one thing that you're grateful for. Are you doing it? Have you got something in mind? One thing that you're thankful for. Now I want you to think of one thing that you're not thankful for. Can you think of something? Isn't that amazing? They say every cloud has its silver lining. Yeah, but every silver lining has its cloud. Do you realize that we're nearly always grateful for one thing in spite of something else? See, there's something in your life tonight that's making you happy, But there's something else in your life tonight that's making you unhappy. If you dwell on it, if you name your life after that. See, good and evil run on parallel tracks, and they usually arrive about the same time. If I spend all of my time trying to unravel those two and trying to say, now, which is which? Is this good, this bad? This is good, this bad? I'm wasting my time. I can't always tell the difference because a lot of times that bad stuff, well, I don't know. Let me illustrate it. Kay and I have a couple. We've been friends for years and years. Well, their daughter met a young boy, began to date him. And this young man, the parents felt, had some serious character defects. So parents did what parents of daughters are wont to do. They informed their daughter of all the character flaws in this young man. And the daughter did what daughters are wont to do in this situation. That just made her that much more determined, you know, to stay with him. And she fell in love with him and married him. Unfortunately, parents were right in their evaluation of that young man. He did have some serious character flaws. And a few years and two babies later, he abandoned her. Just walked out on her. I've never seen anybody, I don't think, hurt as much as those parents hurt. This is their little girl, abandoned by her husband. The shame, the embarrassment, the heartbreak. We were with them on many occasions. We'd cry with them, pray with them, wishing that we could somehow bind up their broken heart. Well, one night we'd been with them. We were driving back home, Kay and I. And I got to think, you know, do you ever fantasize about being God? I do that a lot. I fantasize about being God. You know, when I was a little boy, my mom used to iron listening on the radio to Queen for a Day. Now, there's been a recent Queen for a Day on TV, but that's not what I'm talking about. Now, this is an old one back way. Some of you know what I'm talking about. And I still have a picture in my mind of my mom standing at the ironing board, ironing clothes that she had wrapped up in the refrigerator. They don't do that anymore either, do they? You keep them in the refrigerator overnight. Well, you do, you know, and that somehow or another that helps. But, and I can still remember that radio program, Queen for a Day. And I can still hear the squeals of those women when they won it, you know, Queen for a Day. I've always wanted to be God for a day. Just one day, God. Well, I'll straighten some things out in this world. It'll be a busy day, but I'll get it done. I don't know about you, but I think God's letting an awful lot of good power go to waste up there. You know, there's so much He could be doing that He's not doing. And so I got to fantasizing about what if I were God, I would never have let this happen in the first place. I got this idea. What if God gave me a special dispensation that I could change this? And so I go to my friends and I say, hey, boy, have I got news for you. You are going to be thrilled in your wildest imaginations. You would never have dreamed this. God has given me the special power, one time only offer, but God has given me the special power that I can turn back the clock, turn back the calendar, make it where your daughter never meets this boy, never marries him, he never abandons her, she never knows the heartbreak, you never know the heartbreak, you never shed the tears, it never happened, and life can go on happy. I can do this for you. You want me to do this for you? I can do it, boy. I mean, isn't that great? I can do this for you. You want me to do this for you? Oh, there's one thing that I probably ought to mention before you make your decision. You do understand, of course, that if I do this, you'll have to give up those two grandbabies. What? Sure you want to keep the grandbabies, but you can't have both. You don't want the heartache, do you? No, I thought not. You'd like to have all this erased, all the pain and the misery. Yeah, sure, I can do that. What? The grandbabies? Listen, make up your mind. You can't have one without the other. You know, if you want the grandbabies, you're going to stay with the pain. It's all right to it. But you want to get rid of the pain, don't you? Of course you do. That's what I thought. Okay, I'll do it. What? Well, you're just impossible. Make up your mind. What'll it be? Now, folks, I'm not a grandfather, as you can probably tell. So I don't know how I'd answer that question. But I have a sneaking suspicion there's some granddads and grandmoms out here in front of me. How would you answer that question? What would you do? I'm not asking you what you'd do. I'm asking these people what they'd do. What? I'm losing the battery. Well, that's not all I'm losing. I've lost better things than a battery before. And go on. You know, sometimes I want to say, God, I'm trying to preach down here. All right. You know. And he says, oh, that's what you call it. Well, let me ask you, grandparents, what's your decision? What would you do? Well, everyone I've talked to have always said, oh, preacher, we can't give up those grandbabies. Well, that's interesting. I was in Lake Charles, Louisiana. On the last night of the meeting, there had been a woman been running the book table. And I walked past it as I was leaving, and her husband was there. I had not met him. He was younger than I am. I guess he was in his mid-40s. He was standing there, and he had in his hand a little pink bundle. And I went over there. I said, oh, what have we got here? And I pulled back the bundle. There was a little pink face, little baby girl. I said, oh, what have we here? And a man began to cry. I said, oh, preacher. He said, when my teenage daughter came home pregnant, he said, it was the worst day of my life. But he said, preacher, this little girl, I wouldn't take anything for her. Now let me ask you a question. How can you say that everything that happened in that experience was all bad when out of it comes two precious lives that you'd die for? You understand what I'm saying? Folks, life's not that simple. You can't always just separate the good from the bad. They grow together. And it's up to you to name which one is going to dominate in your life. Good and bad run on parallel tracks, and they usually arrive about the same time. Well, I also like to imagine what must have happened the next day, you know. Everybody over here waiting for the appearance of Jacob, Rachel, and Leah, and all of his 11 children. They're waiting. Oh, there he is, someone says. Yeah, right there, over there. Yeah, I see him. Yeah, he's just stepped out behind those bushes, and he's making his way across that little... Well, look at that. Boy, look at that limp. Man, my goodness, he's got a bad limp. He must have broken a leg or something during the night. Boy, he looks terrible. Well, the closer he gets, you see more. Look at that. His clothes are dirty and torn, and his face is bruised, and his hair is all disheveled. He looked like he'd been in a dog fight, and the dog won. Oh, Jacob limps up. You say, Jacob, what happened to you? And he smiles and says, oh, I got blessed last night. And you watch him as he limps off. Doesn't look like any spirit-filled Christian I've ever seen. No, they usually don't. Usually what you see is the limp. But what they've seen is God.